Will you please remember your own questions? Don't overtax me, will you? Creativity, naiveness and inhibition. Secrecy. Remember your own question, will you? And I shall ask you for it in due course, perhaps next month. I've been asked to talk about the things you just heard, and also real, actual love. As if there's another kind. There is an idea of it, but real, actual love is itself what it is. We'll come at it in a roundabout way. We have defined love, and most of us have agreed to accept it, that love is the working for the development of potentialities of being. It is not desiring one's own way. It is not wishing for one's own pleasures. It is willing to develop potentialities of being in oneself, in everyone. Do we first tentatively accept that definition? Any dissenters? Any dissenters will immediately be thrown out. By kindness, of course. Ahimsa. No twisting of the arms to breaking point. Now, we accept the definition. It is an actual working for development of potentialities. Now we look at potentialities. A piece of potentiality creeping down the stairs at the moment. Is the light too low for you, Trevor? Is the light too low for you? Now, potentiality means power held in. Po means power. It's the same Po in P-O-W-E-R. And its evidence in the human race, historically so far, has been push ability. The W-E-R means man. It's like the V-I-R in Latin, the W-E-R in German, the W-E-R in werewolf. It's a who wolf. Ver means man, and po means push capacity. So power means the push capacity felt and experienced in man. Now the tentia part of potentia means holding. So the potential is power held in. And what we want to know is, what is it that can hold power in? The answer is, it must be power. Nothing but power can hold in power. Do we agree about that? Only power can hold power. So, if there is potential, it must be power holding itself in. Then we have to ask, why? Why should power, which is capable of everything and everything, and which has actually made the universe as we know it, why should power hold itself in? The answer is very simple. If it doesn't, it will go out. Holding in is towards the center. You see the dot in the middle of our diagram? That dot is the dot on the letter I. And the continuous movement of that I is signified by the letter N. So the word I-N means point in continuous movement. To be in means to precipitate a point continuously. Now, what is it that creates the point? What is it that intends to make the point? It has an intention, an inner tension to create the point. The answer is infinite power intends to make the point. Why? Because if infinite power does not make a point, it will remain infinite. Now, infinite means not having a fin, not having an end, no finish. Power that is dispersed through infinity and doesn't make a point is not in any way making itself useful to itself. We'll use the word imagine, although it is quite the wrong word, because to imagine is to make an image. But nevertheless, we will use it and say, let us imagine a non-image, which is entirely power, infinitely extended. Let us call that power by any name we wish to. The highest name to give it is the unnameable or the ineffable, because if we give it a name, the particularized significance of the letters in the name will tie down the imagination to the significance of those letters. So if we say the letter B, which is in the English word B, and is also in the first letter in the Old Testament in the Hebrew, a B, a Beit, Reshit, the beginning. To be already symbolizes a sphere in two dimensions, a circle. On a flat surface of paper, we have to draw a sphere as a circle. We reduce it to two dimensions. It's not a bad idea, because in fact, a sphere of power, when it precipitates itself and then rotates, spins itself out into a disk. So that the solar system itself is a kind of flattened disk, although originally it used to be a sphere. And as its pressure on its center increased, so the resistance of that center increased, and the result was the conflict between the centripetal inner pressure and an outflying pressure, and the result was a rotation. And as the rotatory speed increased, so the sphere gradually flattened and became a disk. Let our diagram represent such a disk, with a point in the middle, which is the point of origination of the disk. And imagine that beyond the circle I have drawn, there is an infinitely extended power. And if the power didn't precipitate that point and that circle, that power would remain eternally unmanifest. Eternally means not in time. Imagine a non-time, eternal power, sentient, capable of feeling, but not having made something to feel. There is just a potential of feeling. There is no feeling. You can do that to yourself if you try. All you do is take any point, any idea you have, see that the idea, the point, is in space, then begin to identify with the surrounding space and spread out consciousness and keep spreading it until it becomes infinitely extended. How do you feel? Can anybody tell me? The ladies all know how they feel. How do you feel with no center? Spread infinitely. What is it like? Did somebody say terrible or horrible or something? Horrible. Horrible is a good word, because when you say the word horror, you should say it deep down in your throat, where an Arab or a Hebrew would say the letter kuf, which you make in a try to say O down your throat, not in your mouth, and then try to stretch your throat infinitely, and you make a noise. Now that is the original sound of the word horror. Can you feel the vibration of the walls down below in that deep well of the throat? The vibration is the letter R. You've got three of them in the word horror. And it means that when you try to extend yourself to infinity, you will begin to shake and you will feel horror. You will feel that you are undoing your being. Now, the original form of the letter B was a sphere, which, written on a flat surface, a piece of papyrus or paper, became a circle. And then that circle was modified in various ways, subdivided, so that our letter B is two hemispheres, or two half circles, one placed above the other. Think that the letter B originally is a sphere precipitated from infinity to make a place in which there can be security. in which there can be being not invaded by horror. Outside that sphere, which we call the sacred space or sacred place, which is the origin of all religious buildings, temples, churches, cathedrals, that sacred space, that walled city, that Garden of Eden, outside it there is infinities of energies all battling chaotically. There is no non-energy. All energy is sentient, so that the infinite energies, if they are not bound within a sphere, are in continuous chaotic motion, and they feel this chaotic motion as anxiety, as the background anxiety which depth psychology tries to discuss. Now, in our drawing here, we have a circle, and I want you to think that that circle has been precipitated from the dot in the center to try to make elbow room for the dot in the center to operate. The dot has been precipitated from infinity, but the dot can feel infinity pressing upon it and is pressing backwards to that circle to try to stop infinity squeezing the dot. Let's see why it should do this. You all know the Big Bang theory in astronomy, don't you? That at some remote period, fantastical amounts of energy pressed into a point. Imagine the energy that's pressing in is literally infinite, and it's pressing in onto a point which is finite. Now, can that finite absorb infinite energy? No, it cannot. If the infinite energy presses in onto the point, and the point does not defend itself against that infinity by pressing back, then the point will explode. This is the origin of the astronomical Big Bang. Infinity pressed onto a point, and then it pressed so hard that the point couldn't take any more, and the point was shattered and flew to bits. And those bits are the universe that we now know. They are the stars, the systems, the solar system, the planets. All these are little bits of that primordial explosion. Now, every little bit of that explosion is still being pressed upon by infinity. And it is pushing out against infinity by that law called the law of opposite action reaction. To every action there's an opposite equal reaction. Therefore, when infinity presses on a point, the point pushes back to give itself a little bit of space. So in this simple diagram, we are to remind ourselves the point is precipitated by infinity and then stretches to push infinity back to avoid the point exploding. Now, Herbie's point was about creativity, wasn't it? Creativity. Now, creativity, create, is from a word, kra, to arc, K-R-A. Read it the way the ox ploughs, and you have two words, kra and arc. The arc is that sphere. It's the same arc as Noah's Ark in the Old Testament. It means the arc of intelligence, the arc of comprehension, the arc of a sacred place in which work is to be done. So to create means to encapsulate, to arc. What is creating is infinite power. What it is creating is a point. The point is elbowing back the infinite power to a certain distance, and in principle could elbow that power back to infinity and cease to be. But the whole power is fundamentally intelligent. So when it presses into the point, the point is allowed to press back a certain distance, and the distance to which it presses back is marked by that encapsulating line of the circle. Now for us, that circle is our skin surface, and the point in the center, we will say, is the region of the solar plexus and the heart. They're very intimately related. The solar plexus is a kind of very primitive brain. It is an original centre from which power, pressed in from infinity, presses out to a certain distance, and the distance it presses out to is marked by our integument, our skin surface. So there we have a drawing of a simple being. Now we have put two lines into it, a vertical and a horizontal, to symbolize, and this symbolism has history of thousands and thousands of years, of deep thought by some of the best intelligences in the world. The vertical is used to represent the activity of infinity pressing in upon the point, and the horizontal is used to represent the passivity of the point to that recipient power. So we have a circle, which is our integument, our skin surface. The planet has a surface also, and it has many surfaces above the terrestrial surface. There is an atmosphere as well as a geosphere, there is a hydrosphere, there is a pyrosphere. There are many spheres at different heights from the Earth, and they're all products of energy from infinity pressing in and the centre reacting outwards to certain distances. All these spheres around the Earth are carried with the Earth in orbit around the Sun. The whole solar system likewise has a skin. The whole galactic system has a skin. The totality of all stars has a skin, just like we have a skin. And the skin is the product of pressure from outside and inside, holding itself in balance. Now, because that skin is a balancing zone, this is called heaven and firmament. If you read in your book of Genesis, you will find that there are waters below, that means inside the circle, and waters above, that is outside the circle. Or you can reverse the symbolism and say waters below are outside and waters above are inside. But the line between the inside and the outside is called the firmament, the place of firmness. And the firmament is called heaven. And heaven is from a verb meaning to heave up. Because the point, when the power pressed in from infinity, pressed out to a certain distance and achieved a kind of balance. So that our skin surface is the balance zone between internal and external pressures. Now you all know that at very great depths in the sea there are certain fish that are conceived down there and live down there under tremendous pressures, and they're exactly as if they're free. As free as a bird in the open air, they swim about. But if a diver goes down there and brings one of these fish up to the surface, where it is not used to the lessened pressure, the fish explodes. It has been brought up in tremendous pressure, and if we take it out of the environment of that tremendous pressure and lift it out of the water, it promptly explodes. Now that's what would happen to us if we were removed from the pressures that are imposed on us from infinity. So we have to think about ourselves as pressure zones. We'll find this is psychologically very important. Pressure zones in which we have attained a kind of balance. And the balance zone is our skin surface, our integument. When we look at the diagram, we commit this diagram to memory. It is called the key diagram to all religions and all philosophies, because it says creation is arcing. Arcing is encapsulation, ensphering, encircling. On the flat surface, remember that the sphere becomes a circle. In the circle, there is a precipitated point that pressed back against infinity and drew the circle round it as a defense against infinity by permission of infinity, because infinity could defeat it, and then it would explode, there'd be another big bang. Within the circle, the vertical line represents the activity and the horizontal, the passivity. The activity originates in infinity and precipitates the point. The point is passive to that activity, and its passivity is represented by the horizontal. Now, let's see how this applies to us as human beings. We, whether we like it or not, are precipitants of infinity. Now, infinity is power, and that power is sentient, and therefore, and for no other reason, we are sentient. We are local modalities of infinite sentient power. That means to say that if we call the infinite sentient power the Godhead, then we are modalities of the Godhead. You know that when Jesus, that Jewish prophet, was accused of blasphemy, he quoted the Old Testament, "Is it not written in your law, ye are gods?" We are all modalities of that infinite sentient power. As such, we are absolutely, unavoidably self-determinant, because we have no self separate from that infinite power. And that infinite power has pressed in to make each one of us. We are points of reference for infinity. We have been allowed to press out to make a bit of space, living space, for ourselves and put a skin around us. And within that skin, we have developed organs, circulation of our own, so that one great sage said, if there were only one self in the universe, and all the others were illusions of the one self, that's a solipsist position, if there were only one self, then the salvation of one would be the salvation of all. But that is manifestly untrue, because one person may be saved and another not. One person may be intelligent, another not. One person may be knowledgeable in a given field of science, technology, art, so on, and another not. So in effect, we have to say that the individual point precipitated from infinity is absolutely self-determinant. It is itself infinity pressed in to that point. So if I were to complete the diagram, I should really have an infinite piece of paper, and I should draw circles all over it, and I should have dots in the centers of those circles, and each dot would represent an intelligent being precipitated from infinity. That is tremendously important, because that dot is no more and no less valid than the infinite which precipitates it. And that means that any individual living being has absolute backing for its being and its behavior. And that means that every living individual human being is absolutely self-determinant and literally does not need to take orders from any other human being. Every individual human being is an absolute self-precipitate and self-authority for its own behavior. It's the absolute source of its own intelligence and the absolute source of its own knowledge and its own functional capacity. Now, if that is so, why is the world in a mess? Why is the world at war? Why is the world split? Why are we hurrying madly towards World War III? Why are two brother religionists from Iraq and Iran, both Muslim, fighting each other? Why are the Russians looking at the Americans with suspicion? Why do the British look at suspicious everybody? The answer is simple. Every individual point is a point of the absolute, is absolutely self-determined, and therefore can, but doesn't have to, can, from its absolute source, decide to go its own way. Can be what we call self-determinant, can ignore other centers, although they exist. Between two heads of Abel and Trevor, I can see Bernard. That's three people. I know that because they are three centers, they could actually disagree with each other by act of will, although they three know that they are centers of intelligent power, and they could have a conversation, and they could be in total agreement with each other. If they so willed, they could disagree. They could deliberately create disagreement. Now, why would they do this? And the answer is very simple. The point that has been precipitated has been allowed to press back to create a working space around itself, which is its own territory. Now, you've seen birds, perhaps seagulls on the seashore, with a little bit of territory during the nesting season, and they mark their own territories out, and they put bits of seaweed down, and they will have a fight with each other if one treads over the circle of another. It's interesting that the one that invades gets beaten, and the one that's at home usually wins, unless he's either very old or very young. So here we have a situation in which we are powers held in, and therefore potentials, from infinity, potentials of infinity, held in by infinity, but what we want to do is have more space. Instead of accepting the space that has been allotted to us for our being by infinity, we want more space. Hitler called it Lebensraum, living space, and we all want a little more space. A slightly bigger car, a slightly bigger house, slightly bigger bank balance, and so on. And this attempt on the part of the individual points to extend its working space causes conflict between individuals, between groups, between parties of politicians, between nations. There is no other source of the world's troubles other than this, that each individual point is absolutely valid from infinity, can make living space around itself, and then can illegitimately, that is contrary to infinite intention, try to extend its space and reduce the living space of those around it. And when this happens, we get conflict. Now that is the opposite of love in act. Love is working for the development of potentialities of being. So actual love in act helps every being, including itself, to extend and express its potentials, but it does not try to restrict the potentials of other beings. Now, on Earth, we're in a finite situation. The countries, the available land is finite, and nations spread out looking for raw materials, and individuals spread out looking to make vast fortunes out of those raw materials, and they squeeze other nations. When they do that, the infinite power that precipitates all individuals then proceeds to move forces of opposition against the ones that illegitimately try to spread out. So for every aggressive person, there is a reaction created from infinity in other persons. Now let's look upon this diagram as a diagram of the Garden of Eden, and there are four rivers flowing out from it. Those are the four arms of the cross. We will look at those four rivers in relation to the four beasts present in a vision recorded in the Bible and appearing in the zodiac as the four fixed signs: Taurus and Leo and Scorpio and Aquarius. Now those correspond to the fixity of your physical body, that is Taurus, the fixity of your heart and solar plexus center, that is Leo, the energy in your body, the fixity of your sensuality, that is in Scorpio, your pleasure seekings, and the fixity of your intellect in Aquarius. So we have those four signs to represent the individuation of four functions of the infinite as they manifest in any closed system. We have a physical body, Taurus. We have desires in that body, opposite to it, that move it and devote it to things. That's in Scorpio. We have a fiery energy in Leo that provides the motive power. And opposite to Leo, we have Aquarian intelligence, intellect, formal knowledge. Now we all have a body, we all have desires, we all have energy, we all have intellect. Those are the four focuses that function in us. The Garden of Eden literally means the guarded place in which one is not to judge. The judgment is to come from infinity. It is not for the individual egotistic mental structure to judge. Why not? Simply, it hasn't got sufficient data. If you have insufficient data, you can't judge. Supposing we decided we would make a probe, and this probe, just for fun, instead of going round a planet like Jupiter and photographing it, we decide to launch into the centre of that planet some fantastically powerful nuclear bomb. And the result is a violent explosion made by man on Earth with all his technology, and the explosion inside the planet Jupiter produces a reverberation, and that planet breaks up into bits and becomes several other planets. Immediately the orbiting of that planet changes, and the planets on either side of it change. The planetary behaviour of the Earth must change, the weather must change, the living conditions must change. So that would be an arbitrary and foolish act to do. We haven't sufficient data to know what will happen, and therefore we must go very, very carefully. Now, what we call a naive being, this is your question, isn't it? A naive being is a being that functions like Eve in the presence of the serpent. Think of Na, which means serpent, and think of the Eve at the end of it. It's just another joke about Eve in the garden. In the garden there are to be no judgments made on insufficient data. The data are insufficient through the five sense organs. Luckily we have another sense, a sixth sense, which when perfectly quietly balanced will tell us the intentions of the infinite power that created us. But if we don't listen, and instead we collect information from outside our physical bodies, from other bodies, by observation, we forget the infinitely extended power is intelligent. We forget that it is our source, and we forget that we cannot win in a battle against it. Now, when the serpent in that mythology is represented as saying to Eve, God has said you shall die, but you will not die, that serpent is sensuality. The serpent symbolizes the subtlety of the sensuous life, which is essentially female. That is to say, not intellectually conditioned. It is a life of wishing and wanting and pleasure orientations without the restraints of solid logic. So Eve listens and she looks at the forbidden fruit and she said, it looks very pleasant, it tastes very nice, and it confers upon me the same wonderful capacities that God has. And that's equivalent to a small zone saying, well, the fruit is there, the infinite has put it there. He hasn't put it there for nothing, he's put it there for something. So without waiting to find out for what he's put it there, I will eat it, and I will find it nice to look at, pleasant to taste, and it will confer power on me like my origin has. All of which are very, very nice. Except impossible. Why? Because no finite with an integument can equal infinity without an integument. And the peculiar thing about this fantastical, ineffable, infinite, intelligent power that we call God is that it is not confined to finite data like we are inside physical bodies through our sense organs. So that Eve is naive when she leaves out to the question, shall I eat the fruit? When she leaves out that it is impossible, eternally impossible, logically impossible, for a finite creature to control infinite power. A finite creature could control finite power, but it cannot ever control infinite power. But infinite power is the ultimate reality. And that infinite power is infinite sentience. It is infinite intelligence. It is absolute wisdom. So imagine all the data in the mind of every individual in this room. And we all know that we have different information. We have learned different things. We have acquired different things. Therefore, as to knowledge, we are unique. We all know, therefore, that if we took the totality of all our knowledge and put it all together in one brain, and we could do this actually, and within the next few years we'll be doing it experimentally, we can actually vibrate one brain by another brain. This has already been demonstrated on oscilloscopes, of wiring people onto separate oscilloscopes and letting the conditions of one person influence the condition of another. This is most obvious in the case of a mother with a newborn baby, where they're not yet separate, so the processes in the baby are determined by the processes in the mother. This being so, it is quite conceivable, and within the next few years can be demonstrated electrically, that all the information in all the brains in all this room could be focused. They could be posited in Dr. Wadsworth, so that suddenly you look in his brains and he would have all the knowledge that all of us have together. We would only have our own particular knowledge, but he would have all of it. Now that is a very nice dream, isn't it? To think of a person with total knowledge and everyone else without it. Because, did somebody say no? Somebody said no, yes. Yes. You don't like that? Oh, all right, we'll take it from Dr. Wadsworth and give it to Greta. No. It is possible. It is possible, yeah?
It's the idea.
And it's the idea and the ideal for men of power who have dedicated themselves, Hitler-wise, in the world to have that power. Right?
And it's terribly dangerous.
Terribly dangerous because it can be done. If it couldn't be done at all, it wouldn't be dangerous. It would be rubbish. It would be fantasy. But it can be done. It is possible to get that kind of information and to misuse it.
Yes.
Yeah? If somebody has it, it can be dangerous. Because then you're dependent entirely on the will of that being, about what he does with your relatively deficient knowledge, if he's got it all.
It's better if
he wants to have it.
Possible whereby you don't let go of your bit.
That's the dot in the middle saying, I'm not going to let go of my bit. Now, you see, luckily the infinite has posited all these little dots for the purpose of the infinite. Each little dot is a measurer, a caliph, for God, for the infinite. As long as you measure your bit and do what you're told by the infinite, you're okay. But if you say, I think I'll do my bit on my own, I'll do my own thing, I will think I did it my way. Yeah? If you do that, you're in trouble. Only because the infinite is infinite and you're finite. If you were infinite as well, you could fight the infinite forever. And say, well, it's a matter of definition, who is God? We will have an eternal battle, like the battle of magicians. But the fact is that we are finite, and if we identify with our finitude, we remain finite. And we are conditioned by the finite data that we have in our mind. And to think that with that finite data we can conquer infinity, which is the dream of scientists, is naive. It's being as silly as Eve, when she thought that she could not only have a nice pleasant apple to look at that would taste nice, but also be like God. Because in fact that word God signifies the invisible infinite omnipotence, and therefore it cannot be defeated. Hence it is said that the battle for the dominion of the world was won before the foundation of the world, before that circle is precipitated. Infinite power is already in charge of it. Infinite power makes it. Infinite power controls the conditions of its work. So the victory has been won. The egotist cannot win, no matter how powerful he becomes. But a strange thing has happened. We imagine that at some remote period, men were more primitive than they are today, if that be possible. And they lived instinctively, like the pre-subhumans, Neanderthal men, people like that. They lived instinctively, and when they saw nature flashing lightning about the place, they were very frightened. And each little child ran to his daddy for protection, right? Isn't that so that the baby runs to mama and papa when there's trouble? I looked at a little boy the other day, and he merely ran behind his mother's skirt. And he wouldn't come out, and that was only a look. What happens if Zeus sends a boat, and it blasts your favourite tree in front of your nose? You go to daddy immediately, don't you? Now, this fact of the behaviour of babies running to parents for protection put an idea that there is a being bigger than man to whom you can go for protection. So the primitive mind built up this figure of the one to whom you run for protection, who is bigger than your own daddy, namely his grandfather, bigger than your own mother, namely his grandmother. And believe me, grandmother was bigger. Some of those great grandmothers were fantastically large creatures. You could really hide behind those in the storm. And this gradually developed itself into the idea of a super being that was called God. And this God is the supreme protective power that can save you even from the lightning. And then arose a little contradiction. This was crude, primitive thought, wasn't it? There was a slight contradiction, because the father of all power that you are looking to for protection was the one that threw the thunderbolt but knocked the house down. So he became a rather peculiar God that you couldn't rely on. He was there to protect you, but suddenly he got bad-tempered and threw bolts about. And then your favourite lady wife, or whatever you thought you liked, was removed suddenly. So you had to placate that God. You had to somehow flatten that God, pacify that God. And that began a whole system of sacrificial activities. And the people in charge of those sacrificial activities gradually built up a system, the system of priestcraft, priest knowledge of how to placate that invisible God. Now it happens that that invisible God is a reality. That is to say, it is power. The ultimate of all things is intelligent power, infinite. And against that power we cannot win. And that power has precipitated individual lives, and especially human lives, to conduct affairs in existence on Earth and later in other planets spreading through the universe, to conduct in his name, in his purpose, the directions and controls to be placed in the universe. But at our present state of evolution, we have individuals who are so fascinated with the powers gained through the use of the intellect, through the use of thought, that they have become highly technologically fascinated. They have become hypnotized by the potentials of technological advance until they come to believe, and with the nuclear weapons, think they demonstrated, they could actually blow the universe out of existence. They're quite certain they could destroy the Earth if they wish. They can certainly destroy vast areas of it. And the power of this is fascinating. And the men who've technologically been advancing along that direction from generation to generation have become totally absorbed with this idea that technological controls ultimately confers power to seize the authority in the universe. and say that God, the infinite invisible power, is of no account. The only thing that can be accounted is that which can be counted. But the God, the infinite, is immeasurable and therefore cannot be counted, therefore is of no account. Then the individual, technologically educated man can actually blow the earth to pieces. That's a peculiar thing about the individual, that when he gets power, he tends to use it. It's so terribly fascinating. If you know how to make a bomb, you tend to make one. And if it blows the roof off the house, you tend to make a bigger bomb and put it in a bigger house, see just when it will not be effective. This is the principle of testing to destruction, which we find in all the great sciences. So that we can say this, thinking, which began as an instinctive accumulation of knowledge, became fascinated with its own capacity for technological development and advance, and the securing of ever more and more power. And then, those people that have that power hypnotize all the others who haven't. That is to say that although people don't like being blown up and don't like Hiroshima bombs, and Nagasaki, and bikinis and things blowing up, they don't like them, but they're fascinated by the possibility of blowing things up, by the possibility of power, by the possibility of control. You know, today, with the electromagnetic devices, it's possible to beam at an ugly crowd, meaning their behaviour, not their faces, an ugly crowd coming at you, it's possible to beam at them and scatter their brain waves so they forget what they've come from. They don't know what party they belong to. And they think, what are we doing here? And they go home. You can actually disperse people. You can kill people with electromagnetic frequency attack today. And the laser is an absolute destructive menace in the wrong hands. But all these things don't only fascinate the men that have had the technological intelligence to make them, they also fascinate a lot of people without that technological knowledge to worship those who have it. So that the men with the greatest power tend to be admired by the ones with the least power, and to think they're actually making inroads into infinity and that they will win the battle for the control of the world. So the Americans are terrified of the Russians, and the Russians are terrified of the Americans, and the Chinese are terrified of both, and they're both terrified of the Chinese. And every other country is a cockpit for testing armaments. Now, all this arises from one simple little thing, that in the evolution of life, points of reference were precipitated, that they elbowed a little space, and they could move inside, like inside your own mind. You can think your own horrible thoughts in privacy. You can even think kind thoughts sometimes in privacy. And then, in the privacy, within your own integument, you can build methods of extending your dominion. Not by blowing the body physically out, but by extending power of thought. Power of technology, power of business. Now when this happens, there is a contradiction inside the person with the power ambition. Because any individual who thinks in terms of power dictating to other people must think also logically that another person might have the same idea. So at the very moment you think in terms of power, domination of other beings by superior technologies, at that very moment you are bound logically to think some other being outside your skin might have the same intention against you. So as long as you have that ambition to have power over other people, you are necessarily infecting yourself with fear that someone else might have the same intent towards you. The moment you think that, you cannot love. You can only defend. Now what we do with each other, what we have done for thousands of years, is this. The point of reference inside ourselves, which is deep in the being, the innermost center of reference, our highest intelligence, has been forgotten. It has been forgotten because the external jostle with other people in communes has extroverted our attention onto the skin surface, so that we do not actually think that we are in contact with each other unless we physically touch each other. So there is Margarita, and there's how much space between us? Perhaps 7 feet between us. Now, if I'm naive, I think we're not in contact. It's not true, because we are both modalities of that infinite power. We are in contact. And if we talk and have conversation and we swap ideas, those ideas are energized by feelings which fill the space between us. So that we all say relation is between beings. There's an egoic point and another egoic point, and between is relation. Now, a lot of people have thought relation, because you can't see it in the space between, is an abstract idea. The egotist thinks that that is only an abstract idea, merely an abstract idea to be ignored, and that the separate individual can pursue his own ways in his own time with his own technology, and that it is quite permissible for him to manipulate all other points of existence in his own terms if he can get away with it. And he doesn't believe there is any relation, because the relation is between and the relation is invisible. But the actuality is that between us all there is a field of sentient power which has precipitated our bodies. So whether we like it or not, we are inside a power that is a relating power. We are in relation, whether we like it or not. If we dislike it and say, well, I don't believe that, that's bunk, that's propaganda, that's religious opium for the masses to suggest that we are in relation in that sense, that we're in power as a wave is in the ocean. And yet that is exactly true. We are in an ocean of power. We are little wave clusters of that ocean within the ocean. And we cannot move without disturbing the ocean. And the ocean, when it moves, disturbs us. And it is quite unavoidable. So then, inhibition. If we know that individual attempts to dominate other individuals by clevernesses, by technologies, by any kind of trick, whatever, if we know that those things are doomed absolutely to failure before we start, then we have to make a metanoia, a total change. It is a total change, that metanoia, that total change of intelligence that occurs when we realize that we are actually little wave clusters in an infinity of intelligent power. We are the instruments of that power. We are not in any way separate. We cannot pursue an individual egotistic aim and succeed. And when it becomes apparent to us with great clarity that we cannot succeed, not ever, not by any kind of subtle trick, when we are absolutely certain, then occurs this metanoia. The thing turns over. And we suddenly say, I'm going to listen to the intelligence that has precipitated that point. Right in the middle of our being is a point of reference which is from infinity. Now, if we say, look at the skin surface, a stimulus comes from outside and hits that. When that stimulus comes, if we pay attention, that is, attend, we tend towards it, we come from the center there, and we go like this, and we make a little record, a circulating record inside us, in that way. Now, which should, in principle, be dominant, the central point, the nucleus of our being, or the external peripheral stimulus on our skin? Which should it be? Both should be given attention. Yeah? Because the stimulus from outside has come from another being. And the stimulus traversing space from another being here is relation. It is energy between beings, and energy between beings, conditioned by the behavior of beings, is relating energy. Our central original intent, which comes from the infinite, which we use the short word God to express, that center is divinity in us. The word Emmanuel means God in us. That is that point in us. There is no human being that hasn't got a point inside himself which is true, which is good, which is beautiful. It is a threefold function. The true, the good, and the beautiful, which is the very centre of our own being. When a stimulus comes from outside, we can actually observe that stimulus with great interest because it comes from another centre, another Emmanuel, and has a meaning. And we can see whether the person who is giving us the stimulus is acting from the Emmanuel in him, that is, in a true act of love, that is trying to develop potential, or whether he is peripherally excited by another one and caught in the identification with the most external concept of domination by external power. If the being tries to force you to do something against your will, he is fundamentally, automatically wrong, even if what he wants you to do is right. If he's trying to force you, he's wrong, even if he tries to force you to do right. Because the rightness, the truth and the goodness and the beauty is inside the centre of every one of us. And we don't need compulsion from outside. What we need is the quietness on the inside to be able to see our own unique, infinitely positive divine centre. So then we can say, if we absolutely allow anybody else to do what they want, but are prepared to discuss with them whether what they want is in accord with the infinite intention or finite surface reactivity, if we can discuss with them, we've done the most we can do. But if we order them to obey because we have discovered the truth, then we are automatically wrong. Every centre is precipitated from infinity by intelligent power. Every centre is therefore itself intelligent power. Everyone has been allowed elbow room to work in. The word energy means in work affirmation within your being. If you try to disrupt the energy functions inside another being by an external stimulus and override the will of the other centre, you are automatically wrong. But if you discuss with other beings about the best ways to develop, then you are right. But the discussion must not be one in which you fly into a very bad temper if your truth, which you know is true, is rejected by the other person. Every person must come to this truth, this beauty, this goodness inside themselves in their own time. Because everybody has a different origin racially, a different origin in environment, and has had to assimilate the data of a large number of different environments, and the data of those environments must be fitted together into a pattern determined from inside the being by the acquiescence of that innermost center. Very shortly, you see that the diagram actually represents everything there is. There really isn't anything else. Now, this same diagram has given rise to many other diagrams simply by drawing further geometry inside it. We can say, we can extend the diagram. By doing this, to remind us of our three functions, our truth of intellect, our beauty of aesthetic appreciation, and our goodness of will. We can do the same thing like this. We have added there the Hebrew Star of David into the Christian cross. The symbolism has the same origin anyway. The two triangles signify the physical world and the internal world. The outer world, the internal world. The physical fact and the internal mental correspondence of the fact. One triangle has its apex at the top, and you are to interpret that one, that it belongs inside you, and the one that's got the apex at the bottom means the external world. For every truth in your mind, there is an external physical possible application. For every sensation of beauty, the aesthetic appreciation in your soul, there is a possible equivalent in an artistic expression. For every thought of a physical activity, there is a possibility of a physical concretation of that. So then we have the six pointed star as two triangles which simply represent the inner and outer worlds. Now, when we remember, and if we forget it, we're in trouble. When we remember that we are all individual points, and this diagram can be drawn for each one of us, and when we read the meanings of the parts of that diagram inside our own being, and remember that any other being can read the same diagram as belonging also to that individual, and that all the faculties that we discover inside ourselves are in every other individual, then we can see immediately we can never win a battle against another individual. We might crush them, we might kill them physically, destroy their possibility of action. We might do a thing like I saw a bit of a program, a strange way, banging up the prisoners. A fellow gets a cigarette that he's not entitled to, and he is stripped of all his clothes and put in a horrid hard calico thing and thrown into a dark cell with no furniture. He's thrown in there. That is to cool him off. Does it actually make him happy that he's been cured of stealing that cigarette? Or does he come out slightly revengeful? Several of those prisoners said that when they got out they would take revenge against society that put them in. After all, they'd only beaten up one man and robbed him, and for that they were beaten up and robbed and ill-treated over a vast length of time. It took them a few minutes to beat somebody up and they get 7 years. Is it fair? In time terms it is not balanced, is it? And so they come out ready to fight again. We cannot cure people of bad behavior, of violence, of unintelligence by beating them up and locking them up. They simply get more and more resentful, more and more divisive. When you say, all right, we'll occupy these prisoners with exercises, we'll get them fit and make them have joy in life, and the muscles get bigger and they go out and they can beat up people more easily. The possible solution of the problem doesn't rest in making vast prisons that get bigger every year and have 3-4 people in one cell, some homosexual attacking the others. The whole thing degenerates. That is not the solution. The solution is inside that diagram, when every individual recognizes that that diagram is true of every other individual. Now, when that happens, the individual begins to inhibit the stupidities. The individual makes his own decision. I, the true observer, will begin to modify my behavior. Now, this modification of behavior cannot occur through the wrong kind of effort. Egotistic effort won't work. If the egotist itself says, I am going to control myself in order to gain more power, it is still egotistic. It's just another technique. So any kind of meditation, any kind of yoga, any kind of thought, whatever, that aims at deliberate, through effort, self-control, by breathing, by sitting, by any technique, whatever, where the object is to gain power over oneself, by the ego doing the exercises is self-contradictory. It isn't done that way at all. The way it is done is to see through the absolute interconnections of power, to see the realities that you cannot win against another individual who on the inside is exactly as cunning as you are, as ambitious as you are, as envious, as greedy, as subtle. If you know that everybody is just like you are on the inside and will interpret your action from inside them like you interpret their action to you, you know perfectly well that you're refuted. And if you just see this, you don't need to make terrible corrugations of eyebrows to concentrate. You look at the realities and you stop messing about. You stop trying to do that which is impossible. You stop trying to divert that person from their own development. You stop trying to divert that person from their own ambitions, their own power building. You just watch it. And in that watching, you stop pressing them, and they feel that you're not pressing them in the space between. In the marital situation, a husband and wife for thousands of years have been brought up that marriage is a contract. Now, a contract is a contraction. It is really a kind of fight. It's a misconception of the relationship. And each one has gone into it for a private motive. One for security, the other for comfort and good meals. The motives are fundamentally wrong, and the effect of wrong motives is also wrong. But the moment that the individual decides that the other individual is exactly the same on the inside, then the effort, the violent effort internally to control oneself by tricks, ceases, and you look at the realities as they are, and in seeing them, your technique automatically changes. If you know that one end of a screwdriver fits in the slot in the screw and the other end does not, which end do you hold in your hand? Do you have to fight yourself? No. When the truth is seen, the truth automatically acts through you. But if you don't see that truth, it will not. Egotism will act for you. You always act on the available data, and if your data are insufficient, your action will be deficient. So the only thing to do is look at the realities. Now, we have done a diagram, you remember, about the worm that dieth not. I'll draw it small down here. A food tube. That's the mouth. That's the stomach. And that's the exit. That is fundamentally a living being. There is the circle that we have drawn in the other diagram, and there is the dot in the middle. And it has extended and made for itself a mouth. And it has extended and made for itself organs of excretion for what it doesn't want. That is called the worm that dieth not. Quite simply, it's your food tube. From your lips to your anus, all the way along is a continuous mucus lining. It is one being with a continuous lining. Now, millions of years ago, when that being began to evolve, it devolved first by being a simple spherical monocell, then by extending itself up and down. It made out of a simple monocell a paramecium with a front end and a back end. The mouth part is looking for the food, and it had inside its mouth a capacity for detecting the salt, the sweet, the bitter, the sour in the mouth. They have different places on the tongue, and by putting out your little tongue you could taste whether it was fit to take in. But when you were very hungry, sometimes you took in things without proper examination because you couldn't wait because you were hungry. Consequently, you put in there something, you start to digest it, Some of the chemistry which is bad for you and bites you and cripples you and destroys you and ulcerates you, you don't like it. So you have to do three things with it. And you choose which you will do in a given order. One is vomit it out, that's very common. One is have diarrhea and get rid of it that way. And the third one is make a message there at the back about that poisonous result and that pain. Now by repetition of that, you build more and more messages out like this, and you keep building them, and the spinal cord was built out of these messages, and when it got to the top, it made a brain, but there's still more messages coming up, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger like that. And then it evolved eyes for looking and ears for listening and so on. Now this is all we are. A food tube, an appetizable being who in swallowing greedily inserts that which is undesirable, hurtful, and then makes a little record and piles the records up and eventually gives rise to that brilliant thing, the brain. So the original appetizable self has built for itself a brain. What happens to the brain? The brain becomes fantastically conceptualized. It actually stores the records of all its pains and of what's not going to happen in future. And it makes eyes and ears to listen for what is damaging and for what might be useful. And it shifts the accent from the food tube, which is very simple, gradually backwards in the spine into the brain. And it shifts the accent finally into the forebrain. And in the forebrain it makes concepts, that is, groups of percepts, records of damages received, and information about that which could be got if you knew how to get it. And this conceptualizing process gathers momentum and makes a great sphere of ideas in the mind, and these ideas are called conceits or concepts. The mind becomes conceited. The stress accent has gone out of the appetizal immediacy, the first immediacy of Kierkegaard. It's climbed up and made a clever brain, and especially a forebrain, that is so full of concepts, the whole accent of consciousness has gone into the forebrain in the thinking process. So then it becomes very, very proud. The forebrain is proud. The forebrain is actually a precipitation of concepts, and therefore fundamentally conceited. It thinks it knows better than an original appetite. But the whole of its energy comes from appetite. You all know the story about the organs in the body saying they were cleverer than the other organs. How the eye said, you wouldn't be able to exist if I couldn't see. And the ear said, you couldn't exist if I didn't hear. And everybody spoke. And finally the stomach went on strike. And when the stomach went on strike, nobody had any energy. And they all gave up. And then the stomach said, now bow down to me and I will eat again, but not until. So then they all had to bow down to the stomach. They had re-established the original relation that was there before the brain evolved. Now we are civilized beings. We have been tricked by thousands of years of civilization and by oligarchies deliberately using this fact that the concept can inhibit the appetite, can actually destroy the appetite, can introduce contradictions from contrary concepts into the appetite, so the appetite doesn't know which way to go. And when this happens, we have neurosis. In its most extreme form, it's psychosis. Most extreme forms of insanity. They only arise from the introduction of contradictions into a primordial appetizable being. Now how do we feel about that? Is it not true Luya Apitago. And when we admit to church, oh, no, not me, I can't possibly be Apitago, I go to church every week. I have transcended all that. Now let's be fair now. Have you got an appetite for truth? If so, you have appetite. All that's happened is the primary appetite for food, for sustenance, has, through the recordings of pain, become an appetite for truth. Because you think truth can get you things better than you can get without it. After all, scientists claim to have discovered truth, and the truth they discover is power, superiority. So there are no activities of the living being that are not fundamentally, unalterably appetival. And the appetite merely becomes technologically developed because it sees that by various techniques it can guarantee appetival self-satisfaction in the future. Or it believes it can. Statistically, it can. Instead of wandering about looking for food, it grows food in a garden. And it stores the grain in the granaries, and it guarantees that if a death comes, it can go to the granary and get the corn. That was terribly clever. And it invented the plough, and that was terribly clever. And it invented oxen pulling the plough instead of men. It invented the bow and arrow instead of the stone. It invented the gun, it invented the cannon. It invented the nuclear weapons. It's terribly clever. And it's all to guarantee that appetite can be satisfied. Now, appetite, basically, is for two things. First, food, because the food gives you the energy, and the totality of all conceivable manifestations in the universe is only energy operative. Energy is sentient. We eat food to get energy. The energy allows us to operate. And when we operate with energy, we have what we call enjoyment. So that, mysteriously, the energy that we get from food is then deployed in enjoying having the energy. That's not bad, that's okay. Then comes another thing. With the growth of technology, there appears another factor, and that factor is leisure. And that's the beginning of a terrible degeneration. Because the primitive man had to go about and work very hard looking for the roots and things that he ate before agriculture was discovered. But when agriculture was discovered, he could store his food in the granary, and he could actually raid other people because he had more energy, and he could come in and bring them in as slaves, and he could make them grind the corn. And he could give himself leisure. If we had not hewers of wood and drawers of water, we would not have time to think about philosophy. A statement of a great Greek philosopher. We would not have time to think about philosophy, to think about life. Who wants to think about life? Well, philosophers do. So they have to enslave other people to give themselves time to do it. And this is the introduction of leisure. And this produces a very peculiar thing. Instead of being kept fit by the daily search for food, which used to be before agriculture, there arose a group of people who had enslaved other groups, and they didn't need to look for food because it was for them there by agricultural methods, and brought and kept in being for them by their slaves, so they had leisure. And the expression of leisure for them was nothing but finding a new kind of pleasure. So instead of just eating food and eating till you'd had enough, the sheer pleasure of having food began to dominate, so that the Romans in the ancient world would make a special room called a vomitorium. So they could go there, eat till they were full, and then go in the vomitorium before they had digested it and get rid of it, so they could go back and eat again and enjoy that. So they had a continuous cycle of eatings and vomitings. That's pleasure. Where there is leisure, there is possibility of pleasure. Where pleasure becomes dominant, you are in the passive, the horizontal role, to the stimulus. Now you lie on your back, and the beautiful maiden holds a bunch of grapes over your mouth. Maybe she even peels the grapes. I happened to Mae West once. The more that is done for us from outside to give us this pleasure, which we can only enjoy at leisure when we are passive, the more we degenerate. The more the organism loses tone, the more the brain cells degenerate, millions of them die through leisure. And yet, funnily enough, the admiration of the slaves for those who had leisure made all the slaves wish they could have leisure too. So many of the slaves use their intelligence to work very hard to get enough money on the side to buy their freedom so they could be at leisure. So the whole of human society went on the leisure pursuit. And then what did it do? All it could do for leisure was lie around eating, and the one other favorite pleasure, sexual relation. So there were two basics there. Food and sex. Now, when you are full of food and tired of vomiting and your sexual performance is flagged through excess, what is the next pleasure you have? Answer, reading about it. Or you employ men of great artistic skill to paint on the walls in Pompeii rude pictures of what you might be doing if you weren't too tired. That is actually what happens. So you eat, and you vomit so you can enjoy eating again, and you get finally tired. I don't know if you've tried this game of eating and vomiting. It's very interesting, very tiring. It also throws an awful lot of rubbish out of your stomach into your pharynx and bends the back of your nose and tongue. That's unpleasant. So you have to cut down on the vomits. The diarrhea is rather hot and burny, so you give that up. If you're a man, your sexual performance is not equal to that of a woman, because you take time, roughly about 5 days, to replenish what you lose. You've got to wait 5 days to enjoy yourself thoroughly again, and she can do the same thing in 5 seconds after she's just finished. That is the fact. Let's start again. He's only just finished. And I mean finished in capital letters. These are facts. And they're horrible facts. Because the lord of the world, namely man, maleness, who should be best in everything, is not best in that. So he'd rather have a calendar supplied by an engineering firm on the wall than the reality. The reality is very wearing. And that is our present position in civilization. So what are we going to do about it? There's only one thing we can do, and that is have this total metanoia, this total change of attitude to reality. We have to say that we are modalities of infinite sentient power, whether we like it or not. That relation is energy between us, and we are ourselves, like wavelets on the ocean, part of that energy. We cannot escape relation. When we realize this fact, and remember that that diagram signifies every other being in existence, we know that we can never defeat anybody satisfactorily. We know that even if we beat them physically, or intellectually, or emotionally, they won't like us for it. We create enemies every time we succeed. So we'll give up the idea of succeeding. That's that metanoia. We'll give up the whole idea of egotistic success. And we'll say now, what about a bit of cooperation? In accord with the infinite requirements of infinite intelligence. All infinite intelligence wants us to do is have intelligent, fully joyful interrelations, because then that infinite intelligence feels our joyfulness inside itself as its own. That is why it says, and God made us for himself. That infinite has made us to enjoy our interrelations with each other, because the joy that we feel, because reality is a continuum, is felt by that infinite power as its own joy, because absolutely it is its own joy. Whereas if we are a pest inside it with our crass egotism and stupidities, we disturb it, make it unharmonious, and it doesn't like what we do. And when it doesn't like what we do, it hits back at us with all kinds of cataclysms in nature and diseases and breakdowns. It has the whip hand over all its finite creatures. So let's just remember that. And when you are, say, in the next half hour and you're having your coffee, just think, the person that you're talking to, you cannot impress. No matter what you do, no matter how clever you are intellectually or emotionally or volitionally, you cannot impress the center of that person in any way from outside. The center of that person is inviolable and will have its own opinion about your great attempt to impress it, just as you have about its attempt to impress you. Thank you.